You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
It's so good to be with you again today. And again, I hope that the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart may lead you on your knees to our crucified but resurrected King. I'll be speaking today again from the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 2, and so you're welcome to have your Bibles open and put your thumb right in there, 2 Samuel, chapter 2. We'll turn to the text in just a second. But first, a few years ago, I ruptured my Achilles tendon while playing basketball with a friend on his 30th birthday. A month or two after the boot came off, my physical therapist turned to me and said, "You know, when I went to school for this stuff, the textbook described a typical Achilles patient. But then I graduated and I began to practice, and it turns out that reality never matches what the textbook says." She leveled a finger at my chest. "Until you." Am I really so predictable? Why do most Achilles injuries happen to 40-something white guys pretending to be younger than they really are? As far as I can tell, the answer must be hubris. Now, I hope I know enough now not to overgeneralize my definition of midlife spirituality under the presumption that it applies to everyone. But at least for me, a slow-motion day of reckoning unfolds at every semi-annual dentist visit where I am reinformed of the gum recession from which I suffer and for which no cure exists. The doctor used to scold me like a child, and now she subtly suggests to her newest hospice patient that we don't need to think about those things quite yet. The change happened overnight in between the graduate degrees. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, I am middle-aged." Which apparently means I can conjure up sorrow at the drop of a hat. Regrets are never far away. For me, they bubble up especially at night when the wind rocks the streetlight out front so that its rays flick back and forth between the crack in the bedroom blinds. And they are not too few to mention, despite what says Frank Sinatra. The original sin of fratricide, when a brother kills a brother in that world just east of Eden, has produced no personal advantage for me as I once imagined that it would, but has generated only poverty and heartbreak. I regret the wreckage, the deep furrows where the vehicle's broken plastic and twisted metal have lodged, seemingly for good. If I could, I would take back that look, take back that word, that sentence, that decision. The silent years slide by, and as our silos deepen, I wonder how and when my siblings and I might discover the humility to confess that we have done exactly what the 20th century willed us to do, that we have been true to ourselves, and that we have suffered immeasurably for it. In the words of Whit Stillman, "What if thine own self is not so good? What if it's pretty bad?" All right, now the second chapter of 2 Samuel begins the story of a war, Israel's very own War of the Roses. It's a competition for control of the Israelite crown, similar to the rivalry between Lancaster and York, and accompanied by the usual bloodbaths and beheadings. Look with me at the first few verses of 2 Samuel 2. 2 Samuel 2, and let your eyes sort of, you know, just glaze over the top of these first few verses. David, who had been living in the Philistine town of Ziklag, asks God what to do and where to go now that he has learned about Saul's death in chapter 1. God directs him to Hebron, so David complies, and there the men of Judah anoint him king. And as his first order of business, David sends a message to the leaders of Jabesh-Gilead, praising them for burying Saul and Jonathan, as well as informing them that they might want to throw in their lot with his. And all that to say, here at the top of the chapter, David shows himself to be a faithful believer, a smart and savvy politician, and a consummate man of the people. Crown him with many crowns, and this war could be over before it starts. Not so fast. A different king, Ishbosheth, son of Saul, ascends a different throne in a different polity to the north. Now, the mere fact that this parallel universe exists to rival David's position in the south suddenly shrouds the story in layers of political intrigue. For the Bible does not simply dismiss Ishbosheth as an illegitimate usurper. It takes him seriously. Now, true, the text refrains from stating that he undergoes an anointing commensurate with David's, but it still grants Ishbosheth the dignity of a regnal formula in 2 Samuel 2, verse 10. Saul's heir was, quote, 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned for 2 years. In other words, we have not one king on our hands in 2 Samuel 2, but two. The stage is set. York and Lancaster grease their shields and sharpen their knives behind the opening curtain, promising a hell of a show. Outright fratricide may loom large on the horizon, but the text itself patiently measures out the beginning of 2 Samuel's war to end all wars in one judicious coffee spoon after the other. With the two monarchs, so that is David and Ishbosheth, with the two monarchs safely barricaded in their respective castles, the two militaries under their commands march to battle, one led by Abner from the north and another led by Joab from the south. The soldiers take up their positions on opposite sides of a place called the Gibeon Pool. And then for a brief moment, the text dangles the possibility of swift resolution before our eyes. In verse 14, Abner from the north suggests, well, if not quite a soccer match on Christmas Day, a gladiatorial substitute for full-blown war, a reprieve. A concentrated, localized kind of violence through which to avoid nuclear winter. 12 men from each side rise to compete, and the whistle blows. Almost immediately, however, the athletes begin collapsing all over the pitch. Brothers stab brothers in the back, and so another of the world's oxymoronic civil wars rumbles to life. Now pay close attention. The text does not specify whose dirty trick turns this vehicle's ignition, and thus which character specifically should attract our moral repudiation for his wicked deed. Did Abner attempt a public assassination of David's men by concealing his true intentions under a veneer of political restraint? Did Joab capitalize on Abner's hesitation to achieve an underhanded, preemptive strike? We will never know. And as far as the text is concerned, it truly does not matter. The story's point is not summed up in the question of who deserves blame, but in the fact that not a single soul who takes the field under the aegis of entertaining his aristocratic superiors survives the match. War swallows them all, without exception. A winner of this contest must eventually emerge, of course, but the attrition portrayed in this opening round between North and South sets David's overall rise to power within a crucial frame of reference. The utter insanity of war, and the great fallacy that violence presents a solution to the problem it purports to address. Didn't I tell you just yesterday, if you were here, that the tragic book of 2 Samuel would be a book about tears? Only a chapter and a half deep, and the corpses are piling up. What if thine own self is not so good? What if it's pretty bad? What then do we do with our human condition? What do we do with our sin? To whom shall I give all of my sorrows and regret? Now, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to pause the biblical storyline here for a brief detour into the world of Old Testament scholarship. Now, admittedly, it is almost never a good idea to describe scholarly debates when preaching a sermon, but I shall risk it anyway. In my experience, numerous interpretations of the book of 2 Samuel remain predisposed to the idea of moral binaries. Throughout the 20th century, numerous biblical scholars attempted to distinguish the supposedly pro-Davidic elements of the book from the supposedly anti-Davidic elements of the book that were layered secondarily onto the text's earliest compositional strata. And as a result, individual passages and even individual verses came to be seen as either praising David on the one hand or as criticizing David on the other, and there the twain shall meet. This reflex bears heavily on readers' conceptions of 2 Samuel's theological message. So, for example, a scholar named R.A. Carlson conceived of David in the first half of 2 Samuel as a man under blessing, but conversely in the second half of 2 Samuel as a man under curse. David Gunn emphasized a thematic tension between David's proclivity either to give, which tends to produce success, or to grasp, which produces disaster. And in the present, the Popular Bible Project, with which you may be familiar, charts David's glorious rise, followed by his precipitous fall. And my frustration in this matter does not amount to an academic's huffing and puffing over an inconsequential pet peeve. Such portrayals of the book's content have an important effect in the pews, because they are so often fused with another interpretive assumption more insidious than the first, that the text's theological value depends on your capacity either to condone or to condemn the character's behaviors at any point in the story. Oh, you might say, there, David is blessed. He gives and obeys. Try your best to act like David, and good will undoubtedly result. But over here, in another place, David is cursed. He grasps and disobeys. Try your best not to act like David, lest a bad outcome obtain instead. The effect of such interpretive flat-footedness is an ethically turgid, theologically useless, rotten tomato of a read. As I am fond of telling my students, if the main point of the Old Testament can be boiled down to the obvious imperative that you should be good, well, it could have been published at less than a hundredth of its current size. On the contrary, 2 Samuel invites us to contemplate a web of tragic memories shot through with theological mystery. The questions that bubble up from within its gory, seedy first few pages have to do with the unpredictable creative mercy of God, not the precise adjudication of each character's performance at every stage along the way. How does God get involved in this mess? Does God make a way for us between the trenches? How exactly does he lead his people out of chronic warfare into everlasting peace? How, in the book of 2 Samuel, will God finally breathe life into what appears, for all intents and purposes, verifiably dead? I'm leading up to the idea that the storyline in 2 Samuel may have a lot less to do with the morality or the immorality of its characters and a lot more to do with the wasted lives that here begin to populate the book's tragic underworld. Following the tournament in which all 24 participants perish, the narrator tells us that Joab's forces defeated Abner's forces in the war's first battle. Now, despite this note, a glorious victory does not appear to fire the author's imagination. Instead, I think he or she seems to have in mind one of those internet videos in which a pride of lions unzips a hyperventilating zebra under a hot African sun. Yeah, the lions win, but are we any better for having watched them make their gruesome kill? Quick like a gazelle, says chapter 2, verse 18. Chapter 2, verse 18, quick like a gazelle, Asahel, brother of Joab, chases down his quarry. Abner scampers away at top speed. Asahel hunts him relentlessly in verse 19. Abner tells his pursuer to alter course. Asahel refuses. Why should I strike you down, asks Abner in verse 22. How could I ever look your brother Joab in the eye? These questions ring out like prophetic church bells in a world where King Henry V's "Once more into the breach, dear friends," has become synonymous with glory, honor, and respect. I wonder, do any of you know how the English king followed up his stirring appeal? He said, and I quote, "When the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of a tiger." It's not about who wins the war. It's about what the war does to the people who wage it. We all become a little less human in the end. In verse 23, Abner rams his spear through Asahel's stomach so violently that it pops out of Asahel's back. And it doesn't get any more real than a spear plunged up through one's gut, or perhaps a set of railroad spikes driven through one's heels and wrists. In the same way that Joab's army begins to rubberneck the bloodbath before their eyes, so too should we, as readers, pause and ponder the crucifixions that we find smeared across the pages of the Old Testament. Let us carefully consider the tragedy of our human condition before we throw our souls one by one into the grave's barbaric yawp. Just a few verses on, Joab and Abner agree to a temporary truce. But in the very next chapter, which we must leave for another day, Joab shoves a knife through Abner's belly. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, brother's blood for brother's blood. All right, perhaps I'm guilty of superimposing contemporary anxieties onto an ancient text that articulates truth through the unapologetic language of military winners and military losers. Don't we live in a real world where evil must be vanquished, battles must be fought, victors must be crowned, and sometimes bodies must be crucified en route to a more perfect union? Maybe. I have never even needed to fight a war, so who am I to judge? I have never even discharged a firearm. But the proof is in the pudding, and 2 Samuel's pudding proves a decidedly messy dish from beginning to end. The problem is, we cannot kill our brothers and our sisters, and then, when we are finally exhausted, simply return to our schools, our saloons, and our worship services as if no regrets worth mentioning had occurred. We change along the way. The war itself becomes our moral formation. I may never have shot a gun, but that doesn't mean I do not own a rifle. It does not mean that I am innocent of assassination, that I am not a red-blooded American through and through. Does not mean that I am anything other than a self-possessed sniper, infinitely more devoted to my way than I am to yours. Were you here yesterday, I wonder? Do you remember the poem that I read? This Lent, as we swiftly approach the barbaric torture and crucifixion of Jesus Christ, George Herbert turns our attention to the musty, dusty church floor. On our way to the cross, he asks us to register in ourselves what has always proven most difficult for human beings to admit: that the foundation underneath all our awesome archways remains checkered all along, For my part, I am neither honest enough nor modest enough to do what Herbert says. I think I need help. I need a physician whose scalpel is sharp enough to cut the parasitic snake coiled around my heart. The book of 2 Samuel is a theological tragedy, sleek and sharp like a knife. And that's no surprise, given its canonical situation within a series of other tragedies that slowly tell the story of a people unable to keep their grip on the promised land. Everything slips away in the end. The kingship, the castle, and the court, the music, the melodies, and the admirers, the wealth, the women, and the wine. No more milk, no more honey. By the rivers of Babylon, we hung up our harps. Anguish replaces laughter in the end. In the Old Testament, as well as in the New Testament, there is simply no shortcut, no Statue of Liberty play by which to avoid Good Friday. All roads lead from the temple down through the Kidron Valley, through the Garden of Gethsemane, and up the Olive Mount. You know, it's funny. The Achilles rupture itself really didn't hurt that much. The pain set in only when the doctor cut open my leg, uncoiled the tendon, and laced it back together again. Surgery hurts. Hither sometimes sin steals and stains the marble's neat and curious veins, but all is cleansed when the marble weeps. Sometimes death, puffing at the door, blows all the dust about the floor, but when he thinks to spoil the room, he sweeps. In the weeks following my hospital visit, I found myself at home in bed with a giant boot strapped to my right leg. I spent my afternoons getting chubby on too much ice cream and my nights writhing around in search of another oxycodone. Meanwhile, my wife worked, and then she worked again, cooking dinners and loading the dishwasher and doing the laundry and sweeping the floors. The whole experience proved a strange foretaste of my inevitable death. I had become a temporary cripple, and let me tell you, I did not like it one bit. I wanted to walk again, if only to feel less like a dependent child and more like a husband, a father, and, you know, a man. My daughter Abigail, who was not quite 3 years old at the time, quickly realized that something had gone seriously wrong with her daddy, for our normal routines had been turned upside down and inside out. So she did a beautiful thing for me. She brought all her coloring books and crayons to my bedside, clambered up into my lap, and spent her mornings creating one ridiculous piece of artwork after another while chatting off my ears. I will never forget the childish mercy she offered to a broken, middle-aged man who was feeling sorry for himself just because he turned out to be more of a human being, more of a sinner than he fancied himself to be. I have read Herbert's The Church Floor hundreds of times now, and usually I have done so while caught up in its tortured acuity for theological truth. You're rereading it in preparation for today and with my daughter Abigail in mind. I was surprised to find myself laughing out loud. How could I have missed its absurd humor? Huffing and puffing at the door like a big bad wolf, and with every intention to spoil the room, death transforms into the church's maid and butler. Through the cross, and through the empty tomb, God gets involved in our mess. God enters the tragedy of the human condition. God allows himself to be torn in half by human violence. But God does not stay dead. God turns this human tragedy into a raucous, unexpected comedy. At the cross and through the empty tomb, God recalculates sin and gets an utterly counterintuitive result. Salvation from the inside out. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.